The contemplating cell. The many-minded neuron. The brain is wider than the sky, for put them side by side, the one the other will contain with ease, and you beside. The brain is deeper than the sea, for hold them, blue to blue, the one the other will absorb, as sponges, buckets do. Emily Dickinson, circa 1862. If the heart is single-minded, then the brain is many-minded. Let's acknowledge one challenge up front. It is impossible to tackle the function of an organ of such immense complexity in a whole book, let alone a single chapter. But leave function aside for a moment. Let's begin with structure. During my anatomy lab at medical school, the students were divided into groups. My group, 4 students in total, was handed a squishy human brain that had been pickled in formaldehyde, a gift to medical science left by a 40-something man who died in a car accident and had chosen to donate his organs. It was an infinitely strange feeling to hold an organ, about the size and shape of a large boxing glove, and imagine it as the repository of memory, of consciousness, of speech, temperament, sensation, and feeling, love, envy, hatred, compassion. All of these had reposed in some tangle of neurons. I was holding him, I thought, this man whose name or identity I would never know. Somewhere within that organ lived the neurons that had once remembered his mother's face. Somewhere was the memory of his last moment before the car had hurtled off the road. Somewhere, the melody of his favorite song. From the outside, the most extraordinary of all organs looked extraordinarily dull, a bulk of tissue sheathed in curvilinear bulges of gray matter. A cerebellum, each of its 2 lobes the size of a child's fist, hung below. There were protrusions on the 2 sides of the brain, the thumbs of the boxing glove seen from the side, a severed stem-like nub of tissue was the site where it had once connected to the spinal cord. But as I sliced into the tissue from the side, it was as if I was opening a box of wonders. There was a seeming infinitude of structures, beltways of nerves, ventricles filled with fluid, sacs, glands, and dense clusters of nerve cells called nuclei. The pituitary gland, one of the few unpaired glands in the body, dangled like a tiny berry from the middle. The pineal gland, which Descartes thought was the seat of the soul, was also nestled in the center. Each of these glands and nuclei contained a unique set of cells dedicated to some particular and often distinctive function. How this endless array of structures and an equally endless array of cells, neurons, hormone-making cells, and glial cells, the non-neuronal cells that support the function of the nerves, ultimately enable the brain's profound functions cannot be captured in a book on cell biology. But the function of the neuron, the most essential unit of the brain's whole, is where we might begin to understand the brain. For several decades in the late 19th century, the most versatile and mystifying of cells in the body was not even considered a cell. In fact, it was not visible to most microscopists. The structure of a neuron was largely hidden. In 1873, Camillo Golgi, the Italian biologist working in Pavia, found that if he added a solution of silver nitrate to a slice of translucent neuronal tissue, a chemical reaction occurred, resulting in a black stain that accumulated within some of the neurons. Under the microscope, Golgi saw a lacy network. He thought that the network represented a continuous connection, a reticulation, as he called it. Cell theory was itself in its infancy. Schwann and Schleiden had proposed that all organisms were collections of cells in 1838 and 1839, and so Golgi wondered whether the entire nervous system was a spiderweb of cellular appendages, an inextricable tangle of interconnected, contiguous cellular extensions, as one writer called it. It was a mumbo-jumbo theory, as Golgi imagined it. The whole nervous system was like a fishnet, composed of wiry extensions sent out by the brain. A rebellious young pathologist from Spain challenged Golgi's theory. A gymnast, an athlete, and an avid draftsman, shy, unsociable, secretive, brusque, as one biographer described him, Santiago Ramón y Cajal was the son of an anatomy teacher who, in the tradition of Vesalius, took his young boy to the graveyards in his town to dissect specimens. As a child, Gahal was known for his elaborate pranks. His first book was on the construction of slingshots, a fusion, as it were, of his love for accuracy and his disdain for authority. He also drew compulsively birds' eggs, nests, leaves, bones, biological specimens, anatomical structures. All forms of natural objects fascinated him, and he sketched them in his notebook. He would later call this drawing habit his irresistible mania. Gahal attended medical school in Zaragoza and eventually moved to Valencia, where he was appointed as a teacher of anatomy and pathology. In Madrid, he chanced upon a friend who had just returned from Paris, where he had learned Golgi's staining method. Many scientists had attempted to reproduce Golgi's stain, but it was a capricious, temperamental reaction, often yielding just a blob of black stained tissue. When it worked, it typically lit up, or rather silhouetted, the dense reticular network that had led Golgi to imagine the nervous system as an intricate connection of continuous wires. But Gahal's genius involved tinkering relentlessly with the method, again mixing accuracy with his disdain for prior authority. He titrated the nitrate to an exact dilution, cut the tissue into precise razor-thin sections, and used the finest of microscopes to visualize the neurons stained by the black reaction. And, unlike Golgi, what Gahal saw was a radically different organization of cells. There was no tangled reticulation in the nervous system, no hodgepodge of wiry extensions. Rather, there were individual neuronal cells with intricate, delicate anatomy that reached out to connect with individual neuronal cells. He sketched them by hand, in black ink, producing among the most beautiful drawings in the history of science. Some neurons were like thousand-branched trees, with dense arbors of extensions above, a pyramidal cell body in the middle, and a stem-like extension below. Some were like starbursts, some like many-headed hydra. Some had infinitesimally slender, many-fingered extensions. Some were compact, some stretched from the surface of the brain to the deeper layers below. Yet despite their unfathomable diversity, Gahal discovered neurons often shared common features. They possessed a cell body, the soma, from which often sprouted dozens, hundreds, or even thousands of branch-like projections called dendrites, and they possessed an outflow tract, an axon, that extended toward the next cell. Notably, the axon of one neuron, its outflow point, was separated from the second neuron by an intervening space, eventually called the synapse. The nervous system was wired, yes, but the wires consisted of cells connected to cells connected to cells, with intervening spaces between them. Gahal used these drawings, as tenderly beautiful as they were forensically accurate, to propose a theory of the structure of the nervous system. He argued that information traveled unidirectionally in a nerve. The dendrites, those extensions that he had visualized budding out of the neuron cell body, received the impulse. The impulse then moved through the cell body, and it moved out through the axon, through the synapse, to the next nerve cell. The process was then repeated in the next cell. Its dendrites picked up the impulse, transmitted it to the cell body, and then the impulse flowed out through the axon to the next cell, and so forth, ad infinitum. The process of nervous conduction, then, was the movement of the impulse from cell to cell. There wasn't a single reticular spiderweb of cellular appendages, as Golgi had proposed, or a syncytium of citizen cells, as in the heart. Rather, nerve cells chattered with each other, collecting inputs via dendrites and generating outputs via the axon. And it was this cellular chatter, or rather intercellular chatter, that gave rise to the profound properties of the nervous system. Sentience, sensation, consciousness, memory, thinking, and feeling. In 1906, Gahal and Golgi were jointly awarded the Nobel Prize for their elucidation of the structure of the nervous system. It might have been the oddest prize in its history, because it was an armistice more than an award. Gahal's and Golgi's ideas about the structure of the nervous system were precisely opposed to each other. In time, with the invention of more powerful microscopes, Gahal's theory of discrete neurons communicating with each other, and the impulse moving from cell to cell in a directional course, would be proved right. The nervous system was made of wires and circuits, but the wires were not a continuous reticulum, but rather individual cells that had the capacity to collect information and transmit it to another series of neurons. It is one of Cajal's legacies that he never performed a single experiment in cell biology, or at least an experiment in the traditional sense. To see his drawings of neurons is to realize how much can be learned by just seeing. It is to return to characters such as Da Vinci or Vesalius, who imagined drawing as thinking. An astute observer and draftsman could generate a scientific theory as much as an experimental interventionist. Cajal sketched what he saw, and his understanding of how the nervous system worked emanated entirely from drawing cells and drawing conclusions. Even that phrase, drawing a conclusion, illuminates the connection between thinking and drawing. To draw is not merely to illustrate, but to extract a substance, to pull out a truth. It was Cajal's irresistible mania, drawing truths, drawing out truths, that laid the foundations for neuroscience. Return for a moment to Cajal's idea of a neuron, that it is a discrete cell capable of transmitting an impulse, a message, to another cell. What was the message and who was the messenger? For centuries, scientists had believed that nerves were hollow conduits, like pipes, and some fluid or air, pneuma, flowing through them carried a wave of information from one nerve to the next, and from the nerve to a muscle, ultimately causing that muscle to contract. According to the balloonist theory, as it was called, the muscle was a balloon, and when it was filled with pneuma, it swelled like an air-filled bladder. In 1791, an Italian biophysicist, Luigi Galvani, deflated balloonism with an experiment that had changed the course of neurological science. The story, likely apocryphal, runs that his assistant was dissecting a dead frog with a scalpel when he accidentally touched a nerve. A nearby electrical spark reached the scalpel, and the dead animal's muscle twitched as if it had come to life. Astonished, Galvani repeated the experiment with several variations. He connected the frog's leg to its spinal cord using a makeshift wire, one length made of iron and the other of bronze. When he put the two wires in contact, a current sparked through the electrodes, and again, the frog's leg twitched. Galvani assumed that the electricity that was moving from the cord to the muscle was intrinsic to the animal, a phenomenon he called animal electricity. His colleague, Alessandro Volta, fascinated by Galvani's experiment, found that the real source of electricity was not the animal, but the contact between the two metals submerged partially in the dead frog's fluids. In time, Volta would use this idea to devise the first primitive battery. Galvani spent much of his life exploring animal electricity, a unique form of biological energy that he considered his most exciting discovery. But the center of Galvani's finding would turn out to be rather peripheral. Most animals, electric eels and mantas aside, don't discharge bioelectricity. It was Galvani's lesser discovery that would prove to be revolutionary. It was the idea that the signal that moved from nerve to nerve and nerve to muscle was not air, but electricity, the influx and efflux of charged ions. In 1939, Alan Hodgkin, an undergraduate fresh out of Cambridge, England, was invited to work on nerve conduction with Andrew Huxley, a physiologist at the Marine Biological Association in Plymouth. The lab was a large brick building on Citadel Hill, its corridors coursed by a bracing ocean breeze. The location was critical. From the sea view windows that overlooked Plymouth Bay, the researchers could look at the catch coming in on fishing boats. And of all things trawled up from the ocean, there was one most precious to them, squid, which happens to possess one of the largest neurons in the animal kingdom, nearly a hundredfold larger than some of the slender, minute neurons that Cajal had drawn in his notebook. Hodgkin had learned to dissect that neuron out of the squid at the Marine Biological Labs in Woods Hole, and the duo punctured the cell with a minuscule silver electrode, sharpened beyond a pinpoint. They learned to send impulses in and record the output, eavesdropping on an individual neuron's chatter. In September 1939, just as Hodgkin and Huxley were recording the impulse from an axon, The Nazis invaded Poland, plunging the continent into war. The two scientists had finished their first recordings of electrical conduction, and they rushed their paper off to Nature. It was an astonishing work, with just two figures, one showing the experimental setup with the squid axon and a sliver of a silver wire inserted into it. It was the second figure, though, that was breathtaking. They saw the arrival of a small electrical impulse, a mini-wave, followed by a large wave of charged ions moving into the neuron. The large wave subsided and dipped, and then the system was reset to normal. Again and again, when they stimulated the axon, they saw the same rising spike of charge and its restoration to normal. They had observed the dynamics of a nerve conducting its signal to another nerve. The war interrupted Hodgkin and Huxley's collaboration for nearly 7 years. Hodgkin, the engineer tinker, was sent off to make oxygen masks and radars for pilots. Huxley, the mathematician, was deployed to use equations to make machine guns more accurate. In 1945, shortly after the war ended, they resumed their work in Plymouth, scouring the catch for squid and delving deeper and deeper into the nervous system, finding more accurate ways to measure the flow of charge into the neuron, culminating in a mathematical model to describe the movement of ions into the neuronal cell. Nearly 7 decades later, neuroscientists are still using the Hodgkin and Huxley equations and their experimental methods to understand the nervous system. The broad outlines of how a neuron chatters are now understood. Perhaps we can turn to one of Cajal's drawings as a template to elucidate the movement of a signal through a nerve. Imagine the nerve, first in its resting state. At rest, the internal milieu of the neuron contains a high concentration of potassium ions and a minimal concentration of sodium ions. This exclusion of sodium from the neuron's interior is critical. We might imagine these sodium ions as a throng outside the citadel, locked out of the castle's walls and banging at the gates to get inside. Natural chemical equilibrium would drive the influx of sodium into the neuron. In its resting state, the cell actively excludes sodium from entry, using energy to drive the ions out. The net result is that the resting neuron has a negative charge, just as Hodgkin and Huxley had discovered in their original experiment in 1939. Turn now to the dendrites, the many-branched structures that Cajal drew. The dendrites are the site within the neuron where the input of the signal originates. When a stimulus, typically a chemical called a neurotransmitter, arrives at one of the dendrites, it binds to a cognate receptor on the membrane, and it is at this point that the cascade of nerve conduction begins. The binding of the chemical to the receptor causes channels in the membrane to open. The citadel's gates are thrown ajar, and sodium floods into the cell. As more ions swarm in, the neuron's net charge changes. Every influx of ions generates a small positive pulse, and as more and more transmitters bind and more such channels open, the pulse increases in amplitude. A cumulative charge courses through the cell body. Imagine now that the army of invading ions, a charge, indeed literally so, marches past the dendrites toward the neuron cell body, the soma, and reaches a pivotal point in the neuron called the axon hillock. It is here that the critical biological cycle that enables nerve conduction is set into motion. If the pulse that reaches the axon hillock is greater than a set threshold, the ions begin a self-fulfilling loop. The ions stimulate the opening of more channels in the axon. In biology, when a chemical stimulates the release of the very same chemical, it sparks a positive feedback loop. More becomes more. The ion-sensitive ion channels are the linchpins in axonal conduction. They are self-propagating, as if the throng is now a perpetuating crowd, bludgeoning open more gates to the citadel, letting more of themselves in. More sodium rushes in through the channels, while potassium, another ion, rushes out. The process amplifies. The invading crowd of ions cracks open more gates, and even more sodium ions flow in. As more and more channels are unshackled open, a tidal wave of sodium ions enters and potassium ions exit, causing the large positive spike that Hodgkin and Huxley first saw in 1939. The net charge of the axon turns from negative to strongly positive. The cascade of conduction, once sparked, is now unstoppable. It moves farther and farther along the axon. This mechanism of conduction within a neuron, sodium channels opening and flooding sodium in, does not apply to all neurons. Some neurons use other ions, such as calcium, as their mechanism to conduct their signals. The process is self-propagating. One set of channels opens and closes, generating an electrical spike. That first spike opens another set of channels a few micrometers down the neuron, thereby producing a second spike just a short distance farther. Then a third spike, another few micrometers down, and so forth until the impulse has marched to the end of the axon. Most neurons are coated by a sheath similar to the plastic insulation around a wire. The insulating sheath is interrupted every few micrometers along the length of the axon. These unsheathed parts of the neuron's membrane are where the ion channels are located. The electrical spikes are generated at these locations. The spike then moves a few micrometers down the length of the neuron to the next unsheathed location, where it generates the next spike. But once the spikes have sparked through the neuron, equilibrium must be restored. As the cell completes its spike in charge, the channels begin to close. The neuron begins to reset, pumping the sodium out and the potassium in, restoring equilibrium and returning, ultimately, to its resting negatively charged state. If you peer carefully into the squiggly depths of Cajal's drawings, included in the attached PDF, you might discover yet another unusual feature in them. In the thinnest of slices that he cut and drew, and in the most delicate of his sketches, where the neurons do not overlap with each other, there is a minute gap between the end of one neuron, where its impulse terminates, for example at the end of its axon, and the beginning of the next neuron, where the impulse presumably sets off a second one, for example at the beginning of one of its tree-like dendrites. Look again, for instance, at the detail of part of the picture marked G. The boutons that mark the end of one nerve almost touch the dendrites of the next nerve, but they don't quite touch. It takes a courageous person, the poet K. Ryan once wrote, to leave spaces empty. And Cajal, the draftsman scientist, was anything but timorous. That space, about 20 to 40 nanometers in distance, is left blank. It is tiny. You could wave it away. Perhaps it's an artifact of microscopy or staining, but like the negative space in a Chinese painting, that space might represent the most important element of the whole drawing, and arguably of the entire physiology of the nervous system. It immediately raises the question of why such a blank space exists. If you were building a nervous system as a box of wires, then what foolish electrician would leave gaps between wires? But Cajal drew exactly what he saw, the horse of observation leading the cart of theory. And yet again, as with so much in this history, it was seeing that led to unbelieving. How does a nerve impulse, having traversed the nerve as Hodgkin and Huxley described it, move to the next nerve? In the 1940s and 1950s, the eminent neurophysiologist John Eccles, who dominated the field of neurotransmission, argued vehemently that the only means for the signal was electrical. Neurons were electrical conductors, wires, Eccles posited. So why would wires ever use anything but electrical impulses to move signals from one to the other? Who ever heard of a device where the wiring changed modes of transmission between wire to wire? In a textbook published in 1949, Eccles's colleague John Fulton, another physiologist, wrote, "The idea of a chemical mediator released at the nerve ending and acting on a second neuron or muscle thus appeared to be unsatisfactory in many respects." It might be useful to distinguish two broad kinds of problems in science. The first kind, call it the eye-in-the-sandstorm problem, arises when there's such immense confusion in a field that no pattern or roadmap is visible. There's sand in the air everywhere you look, and a completely new pathway of thinking is needed. Quantum theory serves as a good example. In the early 1900s, as the atomic and subatomic worlds were discovered, the heuristic principles of Newtonian physics just would not suffice, and a shifted paradigm about this atomic-subatomic world was required to get out of the sandstorm. The second is its converse, call it the sand-in-the-eye problem. Everything makes perfect sense except one ugly fact that just won't fit the beautiful theory. It irritates the scientist like a sand grain lodged in the eye. Why, she asks herself, won't this one irritating contradictory fact go away? In the 1920s and 1930s, for the English neurophysiologist Henry Dale and his lifelong colleague Otto Lowy, the gap between neurons had become a sand-in-the-eye problem. Yes, they agreed that transmission between neurons was electrical. There was no arguing with the signal that Hodgkin and Huxley had witnessed by eavesdropping into a neuron's impulse. But if everything was a box of wires, then what to make of the spatial interruption between nerves? Unusual for his times, Dale, having trained in Cambridge, followed by a brief stint in Ehrlich's lab in Berlin, initially left academic posts, which he deemed too risky, to work as a pharmacologist at the Wellcome Laboratories in England. There, building on the work of John Langley and Walter Dixon, he began to isolate chemicals that had profound effects on the nervous system. Some, like the chemical acetylcholine, infused into a cat, would slow its heart rate down. Other chemicals could accelerate heartbeats, yet others could act as stimulants to the activity of nerve cells on muscles. In 1914, Dale became the director of the National Institute of Medical Research at Mill Hill outside London. Dale speculated cautiously that these chemicals were transmitters of information between neurons or between neurons and muscle cells that they innervated. Their infusion in the bodies of cats had just stimulated the nerves that innervated the heart, resulting in the heart-slowing and heart-speeding activities, and these chemicals restarted the next electrical impulse. Dale kept circling back to the thought. Chemicals, not just electricity, could transmit impulses from nerve to muscle and even, perhaps, from nerve to nerve. In Graz, Austria, another neurophysiologist, Otto Lowy, also converged on the idea of chemical neurotransmitters. The night before Easter Sunday, 1920, in the brief lull of peace between the wars, he dreamed of an experiment. He remembered very little of the dream, but perhaps it involved a muscle and a nerve in a frog. "I awoke," he wrote, turned on the light, and jotted down a few notes on a tiny slip of thin paper. "Then I fell asleep again. It occurred to me at 6 o'clock in the morning that during the night I had written down something important, but I was unable to decipher the scrawl. The next night, at 3 o'clock, the idea returned. It was the design of an experiment to determine whether or not the hypothesis of chemical transmission that I had uttered 17 years ago was correct. I got up immediately, went to the laboratory, and performed a simple experiment on a frog heart according to the nocturnal design. Easter Sunday, a little after 3 in the morning, Lowy ran to his lab. First, he severed the vagus nerve of one frog, thereby isolating it from one of the principal drivers of the heartbeat. The vagus sent an impulse to slow the heartbeat, and so, as expected, the vagus-lacking frog's heart sped up. Then he stimulated the intact vagus nerve of a second frog, causing the heart to beat more slowly. This, too, was expected. Stimulate the inhibitory nerve, and the heart should slow down. But what factor in the stimulated, intact vagus nerve had stimulated the slower heartbeat? If it was an electrical impulse, as Eccles so adamantly insisted, it could never be transferred from one to another. Electrical ions would diffuse and be diluted during the transfer. The trick in the experiment was in the transference. When Lowy collected the chemical substances, the perfusate, that had emerged out of the stimulated vagus nerve, and transferred them to the first frog's heart, the one that had sped up, it slowed down as well. Since he'd severed the nerve, it could not have come from the frog's own vagus. It could only have come from the perfusate. In short, some chemical substance, not an electrical impulse, coming out of one vagus nerve could be transferred from one animal to another to control the heart's beating rate. That chemical, a neurotransmitter, would later be identified as none other than the one that Henry Dale had identified, acetylcholine. By the late 1940s, as an increasing body of evidence supported Dale's and Lowy's hypothesis, even Eccles was convinced. Dale and Lowy, who received the Nobel Prize in 1936, wrote that Eccles' conversion was like the conversion of Saul on the road to Damascus, when this sudden light shone and the scales fell from his eyes. We now know that the released chemicals, transmitters, are stored in vesicles, membrane-bound sacs, at the end of the axon. Once the electrical impulse reaches the axon's end, these vesicles react to its arrival by discharging their cargo. These chemicals cross the space between one cell and the next, the synapse, and start the process of stimulation all over again. They bind to their receptors in the dendrites of the next neuron, open ion channels, and reinitiate the impulse in the second recipient neuron. A small number of neurons in animals do transmit their impulses between each other through electrical stimuli. Rather than release neurotransmitters, these neurons are directly connected electrically to each other through specialized pores called gap junctions, similar to the connecting pores found in heart cells. The proximity between the neurons is thus even greater, tenfold less than a chemical synapse. Although present, these electrical synapses are rare. Their principal advantage is speed. Electricity moves rapidly from one cell to the next, and thus they are often found in cellular circuits where speed is essential. The sea slug, or more technically sea hare, Aplysia, uses an electrical circuit to squirt ink to obscure itself from predators during its flight response. The signal moves to the third cell. One chattering, thoughtful neuron has spoken to the next. The neuron's two countermelodies are woven together in tandem, like a child's chant: electrical, chemical, electrical, chemical, electrical. One critical feature of this form of communication is that the synapse has the capacity not just to excite the neuron to fire, as in the example just mentioned, but it can also be an inhibitory synapse, making the next neuron less prone to excitation. A single neuron can thus have positive inputs and negative inputs from other neurons. Its job is to integrate these inputs. It is the integrated total of these excitatory and inhibitory inputs that determines whether a neuron will fire or not. I have sketched the skeletal outline of how a neuron functions and how that function relates to the building of the brain, but this is the barest of sketches. Of all cells in the body, the neuron is, perhaps, the most subtle and the most magnificent. The pared-down principle is this: we should imagine the neuron not just as a passive wire, but as an active integrator. And once you think of each neuron as an active integrator, you can imagine building extraordinarily complex circuits out of these active wires. Those complex circuits, you might surmise, could be the basis for building even more complex computational modules, those that can support memory, sentience, feeling, thought, and sensation. A collection of such computational modules could coalesce to form the most complex of machines in the human body. That machine is the human brain. One philosophical and biological question arises: why is the neuronal circuit not entirely electrical? Why not Eccles's idea of building a wiring system simply to conduct electricity, as opposed to build one that constantly moves from electricity to chemical signals to electricity and back again, in endless cycles? The answer, perhaps, lies, as always, in evolution and the development of the neural circuit. A neuronal circuit is not just a wire transmitting signals from the brain to the rest of the body. It is, as I wrote, an integrator of physiology. There might be times when the heart needs to be speeded up or slowed down, or in a more complex realm, mood or motivation might have to be regulated up or down. If neuronal circuits were sealed in a closed box of an electrical wiring system, then integrating them with the physiology of the rest of the body would be onerous and potentially impossible. Furthermore, beyond integration, chemical synapses have the capacity to gain or amplify a signal or dampen it, phenomena that make them more amenable to the building of circuits required for the complexities of the nervous system. Imagine your laptop, a closed box, internally wired system. The laptop cannot know when you are frustrated or irritable or need to work faster or when you need to slow down. It is a box of electrical wiring and circuitry with no synapse with your emotional or mental state. Organs cannot be sealed boxes. A signal carried between neurons, hormones, and transmitters carried by blood or by other neurons must be capable of intersecting with the other signals to modify and modulate their function, thereby integrating neuronal physiology with the rest of the body's physiology, and a soluble chemical mediator is an ideal solution. It can speed up or slow down the activity of a circuit. This is an intelligent laptop that is responsive and complex. Tell it that you are in a bad mood and it can give you feedback to stop sending out angry emails that you'll later regret. Give it a deadline and it speeds up. If a subject has a glamorous aura, if its practitioners are prize winners who receive large grants, the biologist E.O. Wilson once advised, stay away from that subject. For cell biologists exploring the brain, the neuron was so brazenly glamorous, so mysterious, so unfathomably complex, so functionally diverse and exorbitantly glorious in its form, that it overshadowed a companion cell that consistently lurks around it. The glial cell, or glia, was like a film star's assistant stuck perpetually in the shadows of celebrity. Even its name, drawn from the Greek word for glue, signaled a century of neglect. Glial cells were considered nothing more than the glue that stuck neurons together. A small group of diehard neuroscientists had studied these cells since the early 1900s, when Cajal had described them in Slices of the Brain. The rest considered them irrelevant. Not the stuff, but the stuffing of the brain. Glial cells are present all over the nervous system, in about the same number as neurons. At one point, they were thought to be tenfold more common, thereby fueling the stuffing of the brain hypothesis. Unlike neurons, they don't generate electrical impulses, but like neurons, they are extraordinarily diverse in structure and function. Some possess fat-rich branching extensions that wrap themselves around neurons, forming sheaths. These wrappings, called myelin sheaths, act like electrical insulation for the neurons, akin to the plastic wrapped around wires. Some are wanderers and scavengers dedicated to clearing debris and dead cells from the brain, yet others supply nutrients to the brain or mop up transmitters from the neuronal synapses to reset neuronal signals. The emergence of glial cells from the shadows of neuroscience to the center stage of inquiry represents a fascinating shift in the cell biology of the nervous system. A few years ago, I went to Harvard University to visit the lab of Beth Stevens, who has been studying glia for more than a decade. Like so many neurobiologists over the course of history, Stevens found her way to glia through neurons. In 2004, Stevens began work as a postdoctoral fellow at Stanford University to study the formation of neural circuits in the eye. Neural connections between the eyes and the brain are formed long before birth, establishing the wiring and the circuitry that allow a child to begin visualizing the world the minute she emerges from the womb. Long before the eyelids open, during the early development of the visual system, waves of spontaneous activity ripple from the retina to the brain, like dancers practicing their moves before a performance. These waves configure the wiring of the brain, rehearsing its future circuits, strengthening and loosening the connections between neurons. The neurobiologist Carla Schatz, who discovered these waves of spontaneous activity, wrote, "Cells that fire together, wire together." This fetal warm-up act, the soldering of neural connections before the eyes actually function, is crucial to the performance of the visual system. The world has to be dreamed before it is seen. During this rehearsal period, synapses, points of chemical connection, between nerve cells are generated in great excess, only to be pruned back during later development. To create a synapse, the neuron has specialized structures, often seen as tiny swellings, at its terminal end of the axon where it stores the chemicals that are emitted to transmit a signal to the next neuron. Synaptic pruning is thought to involve the paring back of these special structures, thereby eliminating the synaptic connection at that site, akin to removing or cutting the soldering joint between two wires. It's an odd phenomenon. Our brains make connections in vast excess, and then we pare back the excess. The reasons for this paring back of synapses is a mystery, but synaptic pruning is thought to sharpen and reinforce the correct synapses while removing the weak and unnecessary ones. It reinforces an old intuition, a psychiatrist in Boston told me. The secret of learning is the systematic elimination of excess. We grow, mostly, by dying. We are hardwired not to be hardwired, and this anatomical plasticity may be the key to the plasticity of our minds. But who does the pruning of synapses? In the winter of 2004, Beth Stevens joined the laboratory of Ben Barrs, a neuroscientist at Stanford. When I began my work in Ben's lab, little was known about how specific synapses are eliminated, she told me. Stevens and Barrs focused their attention on visual neurons. The eye would be the eye to the brain. In 2007, they announced a startling discovery. Stevens and Barrs found that glial cells were responsible for this pruning of synaptic connections in the visual system. The work, published in Cell, garnered enormous attention, but also threw open a host of new questions. Which specific glial cell was responsible for the pruning? And what was the mechanism of pruning? The following year, Stevens moved to Boston Children's Hospital to set up her own lab. When I visited her on an icy March morning in 2015, the lab was thrumming. Graduate students were folded over microscopes. One woman sat on her bench, determinedly mashing a freshly biopsied fragment of a human brain into individual cells so that she could grow them in a tissue culture flask. There is something effortlessly kinetic about Stevens. As she speaks, her hands and fingers trace the arcs of ideas, forming and unforming synapses in the air. The questions we took on in the new lab were direct continuations of the questions that I had at Stanford, she said. By 2012, Stevens and her students had created experimental models to study synaptic pruning and identified the cells responsible for the phenomenon. Specialized cells known as microglia, spidery and many-fingered, had been seen crawling around the brain, scrounging for debris, and their role in eliminating pathogens and cellular waste had been known for decades. But Stevens also found them coiled around synapses that had been marked for elimination. Microglia nibble at the synaptic connections between neurons and pair them away. They are the brain's constant gardeners, as one report put it. Perhaps the singularly striking feature of synaptic pruning is that it uses an immunological mechanism to eliminate connections between neurons. Macrophages in the immune system phagocytose eat pathogens and cellular debris. Microglia in the brain use some similar proteins and processes to mark synapses that are to be nibbled, except rather than ingesting pathogens, they ingest the bits of a neuron involved in the synaptic connections. It's yet another captivating instance of repurposing. The very proteins and pathways that are used to clear pathogens in the body have been rejiggered to fine-tune connections between neurons. Microglia have evolved to eat pieces of our own brain. Once we knew about the involvement of the microglia, all sorts of questions popped up, Stephen said. How does a microglial cell know which synapses to eliminate? We know that synapses compete against one another and the strongest synapse wins, but how does the weakest synapse get tagged for pruning? The lab is now working on all these questions. The pruning of neural connections by glial cells has become the focus of intense study, and not just in Stevens's lab. Recent experiments suggest that dysfunctions in glial pruning may be related to schizophrenia, a disease where the pruning doesn't occur appropriately. Other functions of different glial cells have been linked to Alzheimer's disease, to multiple sclerosis, and to autism. The deeper we look, the more we find, Stevens told me. It's hard to locate an aspect of neurobiology that doesn't involve the glial cell. I walked away from Stevens's lab onto ice-slick Boston streets, mentally reciting the lines of Kenneth Koch's poem, "One Train Might Hide Another." In a family, one sister may conceal another, so when you are courting, it's best to have them all in view. And in the laboratory, one invention may hide another invention, one evening may hide another, one shadow, a nest of shadows. For decades, the neurons sashayed down cell biology's runway so glamorously that it hid the glial cell. But when you are courting scientific insights or making inventions, it's best to have all cells in view, not just the sashaying ones. The glial cell has emerged out of its nest of shadows. Like one of its own subtypes, it has wrapped itself, sheath-like, around the entire field of neurobiology. Far from the celebrity's assistant, it is the discipline's new star. In the spring of 2017, I was overwhelmed by the most profound wave of depression that I've ever experienced. I use the word wave deliberately. When it finally burst on me, having crept up slowly for months, I felt as if I were drowning in a tide of sadness that I could not swim past or through. Superficially, my life seemed perfectly in control, but inside, I felt drenched in grief. There were days when getting out of bed or even retrieving the newspaper outside the door seemed unfathomably difficult. Simple moments of pleasure, my child's funny drawing of a shark, or a perfect mushroom soup, seem locked away in boxes with all their keys thrown into the depths of the ocean. Why? I could not tell. Part of it, perhaps, was coming to terms with my father's death a year before. In the wake of his passing, I had thrown myself manically back to work, neglecting to give myself time and space to grieve. Some of it was confronting the inevitability of aging. I was at the edge of the last years of my 40s, staring into what seemed like an abyss. My knees hurt and creaked when I ran. An abdominal hernia appeared out of nowhere. The poems that I could recite from memory, I would now have to search my brain for words that had gone missing. I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in my room was like what? I was becoming fragmented. I was officially entering middle age. It wasn't my skin that began to sag, but my brain. I heard a fly buzz. Things got worse. I dealt with it by ignoring it until it had crested fully. I was like the proverbial frog in the pot that doesn't sense the incremental rise in temperature until the water starts boiling. I started antidepressants, which helped, but only moderately, and began to see a psychiatrist, which helped much more. But the sudden wave of the disorder and its recalcitrance mystified me. All I could feel was the dank joylessness that the writer William Styron describes in Darkness Visible. I called Paul Greengard, a professor at Rockefeller University. I had met Greengard at a retreat in Maine several years earlier. We had recognized each other as fellow scientists and walked for a mile on a white-pebbled, windswept beach talking about cells and biochemistry and had become close friends. He was substantially older than me, 89 when we met, but his mind seemed perpetually young. We met for lunch in New York often, or took long, slow walks on York Avenue or on the campus of the university. Our conversations ranged widely: neuroscience, cell biology, university gossip, politics, friendships, the latest exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art, the newest findings in cancer research. Paul was interested in everything. In the 1960s and 1970s, Greengard's experiments had led him to a novel way of thinking about neuronal communication. Neurobiologists studying the synapse had largely described the communication between neurons to be a rapid process. An electrical impulse arrives at the end of the neuron, for example, at the axon terminal. It causes the release of chemical neurotransmitters into a specialized space, the synapse. The chemicals, in turn, open channels in the next neuron and ions surge in, reinitiating the impulse. This is the electrical brain, a box of wires and circuits with a chemical signal or neurotransmitter thrown in between the two wires. But Greengard argued that there was a different kind of neurotransmission. The chemical signals sent out by one neuron also create a cascade of slow signals in the neuron. Neuronal signaling from one cell to the next instigates profound biochemical and metabolic changes in the recipient cell. An elaborate cascade of chemical changes is sparked off in the recipient neuron. Alterations in metabolism, in gene expression, and in the nature and concentration of chemical transmitters that are secreted into the synapse. And these slow changes, in turn, alter the electrical conduction of an impulse from nerve to nerve. For decades, this slow cascade was considered peripheral. "Oh, he'll eventually come around," another researcher said of Greengard's work. But the biochemical alterations produced in neuronal cells, the Greengard cascade, is now known to permeate the brain, change the function of neurons, and dictate many of its subsequent properties. We might then divide the pathologies of the brain into those that affect the fast signals, the rapid electrical conduction of neuronal cells, those that affect slow signals, the biochemical cascades that are altered in nerve cells, and those that fall somewhere in between. Depression? When I told Greengard of the soupy fog of grief that I was experiencing, he invited me to meet him for lunch. It was the late fall of 2017. We ate at the university cafeteria. He was a slow, fastidious eater, examining each morsel on his fork as if it were a biological specimen before putting it in his mouth, and then took a walk around the campus of Rockefeller University. His Bernese mountain dog, Alpha, lumbered, drooling, by our side. "Depression is a slow brain problem," he said. I was reminded of the Carl Sandburg poem, "The fog comes on little cat feet. It sits looking over harbor and city, on silent haunches, and then moves on." My brain felt perpetually fogged, as if some creature had descended on slow, silent haunches, but would not move on. Andrew Solomon, the writer, once described depression as a flaw in love, but in medical terms, it was a problem with the regulation of neurotransmitters and their signals. A flaw in chemicals. "Which chemicals? What signals?" I asked Paul. I knew that serotonin, the neurotransmitter, had something to do with it. Paul told me the story of the origin of the brain chemical theory of depression. In the autumn of 1951, doctors treating tubercular patients at Seaview Hospital on Staten Island with a new drug, iproniazid, had observed sudden transformations in their patients' moods and behaviors. The wards, typically glum and silent with moribund, lethargic patients, were bright last week with the happy faces of men and women, a journalist wrote. Energy flooded back and appetites returned. Many patients, ill and catatonic for months, demanded 5 eggs for breakfast. When Life magazine sent a photographer to the hospital to investigate, the patients were no longer lying numbly in their beds. They were playing cards or walking briskly in the corridors. Researchers later discovered that iproniazid had, as a side effect, increased serotonin levels in the brain. And the idea that depression was caused by the paucity of the neurotransmitter serotonin in the neural synapse gripped psychiatry. There isn't enough serotonin in the synapse, and so the electrical circuits that respond to the chemical don't get enough stimulation. The inadequate stimulation of mood-regulating neurons results in depression. If that was all there was to depression, then increasing serotonin in the brain should solve the crisis. In the 1970s, Arvid Carlson, a biochemist at Göteborg University in Sweden, collaborated with the Swedish pharmaceutical company Astra AB to develop a drug, zimelidine, that increased the levels of the neurotransmitter in the brain. These early drugs led to more selective chemicals that increased serotonin levels in the brain, the SSRIs, such as Prozac and Paxil. And indeed, some depressed patients treated with these SSRIs experienced profound remissions in their disease. In her best-selling 1994 memoir, Prozac Nation, author Elizabeth Wurtzel wrote of a transformational experience. Before she began treatment with antidepressants, she floated from one suicidal reverie to the next. Yet just a few weeks after starting Prozac, her life was changed. "One morning, I woke up and really did want to live. It was as if the miasma of depression had lifted off me, in the same way that the fog in San Francisco rises as the day wears on. Was it the Prozac? No doubt." But the response to SSRIs was far from universally positive, and experimental and clinical results with SSRIs revealed contradictory data. In some trials with the most severely depressed patients, there was a measurable improvement in symptoms for patients who received the drug versus those that had a placebo, while in other studies the effect was marginal, often vanishingly so, and the time to obtain the effect, often weeks or months, did not suggest that simply raising the level of serotonin could reset the level of some electrical circuit and thereby cure depression. When I tried Paxil and then Prozac, the fog in my brain did not lift. One thing was obvious: merely adjusting the level of serotonin in the synapses of the mood-regulating neurons couldn't be the simple answer. Paul nodded in agreement. Greengard's lab at Rockefeller University had just discovered a slow pathway instigated by serotonin that might be responsible for depression. Serotonin, Greengard and other researchers had found, doesn't only act as a fast neurotransmitter, and depression isn't just a malfunctioning neuronal circuit that can be reset by increasing serotonin in the synapse. Rather, serotonin sets off a slow signal in neurons, biochemical signals that come on cat's feet, including altering the activity and function of several intracellular proteins that Greengard's lab had identified. Paul believes that these proteins, which modify neuronal activity, are crucial to the slow signaling in neurons that regulate mood and emotional homeostasis. In his earlier work, he had shown that one such factor, called DARPP32, is critically responsible to the way a neuron responds to another transmitter, called dopamine, which is involved in many other neurological functions, including our mind's response to reward and addiction. "It's not just the level of serotonin," Paul said emphatically, jabbing his fingers in the air. The New York air was clear and bitingly cold, and his breath left a drifting trail of mist behind him. "That's way too simple. It's what serotonin does to the neuron, the way it changes the neuron's chemistry and its metabolism," he said, "and that might vary from one individual to the next." He turned to face me. "In your case, there might be inputs or genetic reasons that makes the response more difficult to sustain or restore. We are looking for new drugs that will affect this slow pathway," Greengard continued. He was searching for an entirely new paradigm for depression, and thereby a new way of treating this disorder. Our walk had come to an end. He had not touched me, but I felt as if he had healed some implacable wound inside me. I waved goodbye and watched him return to his lab. Alpha was exhausted, but Paul was energized. Depression is a flaw in love, but more fundamentally, perhaps, it is also a flaw in how neurons respond, slowly, to neurotransmitters. It is not just a wiring problem, Greengard believes, but rather a cellular disorder of a signal instigated by neurotransmitters that somehow malfunctions and creates a dysfunctional state in a neuron. It is a flaw in our cells that becomes a flaw in love. Paul Greengard died of a heart attack in April 2019 at 93. I miss him dearly. I met Helen Mayberg at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York on a November afternoon in 2021. The wind stung my face as I walked to her office. Autumnal leaves were falling around me like snowflakes, presaging the winter. Mayberg is a neurologist who specializes in neuropsychiatric diseases and runs a center called Advanced Circuit Therapeutics. She is one of the pioneers of a technique called Deep Brain Stimulation, DBS, in which minuscule electrodes are surgically inserted deep into very specific parts of the brain. Tiny bolts of electricity are sent through those electrodes to cells of the brain whose malfunction may be responsible for neuropsychiatric diseases. By modulating these areas of the brain with electrical stimulation, Mayberg hopes to treat the most recalcitrant forms of depression that are resistant to normal therapies. It is cellular therapy of sorts, or rather, a therapy aimed at cell circuits. In the early 2000s, taking a radical turn from the then-current prominence of using drugs, such as Prozac and Paxil, Mayberg began to use a variety of techniques to map cellular circuits in the brain that may be responsible for depression. Deep brain stimulation had already been used to treat Parkinson's disease, and researchers had noted that it could improve the coordination of movement in affected patients. But DBS was yet to be tried in recalcitrant depression. Using powerful imaging techniques, the circuit mapping of neuronal cells and neuropsychiatric tests, Mayberg found one area of the brain, called Brodmann Area 25, BA25, the presumptive residence of cells that seem to regulate emotional tone, anxiety, motivation, drive, self-reflection, and even sleep, the symptoms that are markedly dysregulated in depression. BA25 was hyperactive in patients with recalcitrant depression, Mayberg found. Chronic electrical stimulation, she knew, can diminish the activity of a brain area. This may sound like a contradiction, but it isn't. Chronic electrical stimulation of a neuronal circuit at high frequencies can depress its activity. Mayberg reasoned that electrical stimulation delivered to cells in BA25 might relieve the symptoms of chronic severe depression. Brodmann Area 25 is not an easy place to access. If you imagine the human brain as a folded boxing glove in its punching position, BA25 sits in the deep center of the clutch, just where the middle finger might be. There's one area on either side of the brain. As one journalist described it, in a pair of pale pink curves of neural flesh called the subcallosal cingulate, each about the size and shape of a newborn's crooked finger, Brodmann Area 25 occupies the fingertips. In 2003, collaborating with neurosurgeons in Toronto, Mayberg launched a trial to insert electrodes on both sides of the brain and stimulate BA25 in patients who are suffering from treatment-resistant depression. It seemed like an impossibly delicate task, tickling a newborn's fingertips to make her laugh. There were 6 patients in the study, 3 men and 3 women, ranging between 37 and 48 years old. I remember each one of those patients, Mayberg told me. The first was a nurse with a physical disability. She described herself as totally numb, as if permanently anesthetized. Like many patients that I've seen before and after her, her metaphors for her illness were vertical. She was trapped inside a hole, a void. She had fallen into it. Others would talk about caves, about force fields that push them down into something. I hadn't realized it then, but listening to the metaphors was absolutely vital. It was the metaphors that allowed me to track whether a patient was responding or not. To position the electrode accurately into BA25, the neurosurgeon collaborating with Mayberg, Andres Lozano, had to put a frame around the patient's head. The frame acts like a 3-dimensional GPS system to track the electrode's position as the surgeon introduces it into the brain. As Mayberg tightened the clasps of the stereotactic frame, the patient looked at her blankly, registering neither fear nor apprehension. Here she was, a woman about to have holes bored into her head and a totally untested procedure performed in her brain, and all she could register was numbness, nothing. That's when I knew how bad it was for her. Mayberg brought her to the operating room. Gosh, we were so apprehensive. We had no idea what the stimulation might do. Would it make the blood pressure drop? Turn on a cellular circuit that neuroscientists knew nothing about? Unleash some unexpected psychosis? The surgeon bored through the patient's skull and inserted the electrodes. The position seemed right, and Mayberg turned the current on, slowly increasing the frequency. See the image in the attached PDF. And then it happened, Mayberg said. As we hit the right spot, she, the patient, suddenly said, "What did you do?" "What do you mean?" Mayberg asked. "I mean, you did something and the void lifted." The void lifted. Mayberg turned the stimulator off. "Oh, maybe I just felt something weird. Never mind." Mayberg turned it on again. The void lifted again. "Describe it," Mayberg urged her. "I'm not sure I can. It's like the difference between a smile and laughter." "That's why you have to listen to the metaphors," Mayberg told me. "The difference between a smile and laughter." There was a picture in her office of a stream with a deep sinkhole in the middle, where water gushed in from all sides. A patient sent me that picture to describe her depression. Another void, a hole, vertical, inescapable traps. When Mayberg turned the stimulator on, the woman said she saw herself lifted out of the sinkhole and sitting on a rock above the water. She could see her former self in the hole, but she was on a rock sitting above the hole. Quote, "These pictures, these descriptions tell you so much more than checking boxes on a depression scale," close quote. Mayberg treated 5 more patients with DBS before publishing her data. Here's what happened when the stimulator was turned on. Quote, "All patients spontaneously reported acute effects including sudden calmness or lightness, disappearance of the void, sense of heightened awareness, increased interest, connectedness, and sudden brightening of the room, including a description of the sharpening of visual details and intensification of colors in response to electrical stimulation." Close quote. The patients were sent home with their electrodes and batteries. At 6 months, 4 of the 6 continued to respond, with significant and objective measures of improvement in their mood. "The whole syndrome recovers," Mayberg later told an interviewer. "It can be extremely dramatic in some patients, while in others it takes time to become evident, as much as a year or two. Other patients appear not to be helped by deep brain stimulation for reasons that are still unclear." Mayberg has treated nearly 100 patients. "Everyone doesn't respond, and we don't know why," she told me, "but in some patients the effect is almost immediate." One woman, also a nurse, described her illness as a complete incapacity to feel emotional or even sensory connections. She told me that when she held her own children, she felt nothing. No sensation, no comfort, no pleasure. When Mayberg turned the DBS on, the patient turned to her and said, "You know, it's strange. I feel connected to you." Another patient remembered the precise moment of the onset of her disease. She was walking her dog along a lake and felt that all the colors had gone. They had become black and white, or just gray. When Mayberg turned the DBS on, the patient looked startled. "The colors just popped." Yet another woman described her response as if a season was about to turn. It wasn't spring yet, but she felt the portent of spring. The crocuses, they just came out. "There are still all sorts of mysteries that I don't understand," Mayberg continued. "You know that depression has a psychomotor component to it. Patients often cannot move. They lie in bed, they become catatonic. When we turn the DBS on, patients want to move again, but the activities that they want to do involve cleaning out rooms, taking the trash out of the kitchen, washing dishes. One patient, before he fell into his depression, used to be a thrill seeker. He would jump out of planes. When we turned the DBS on, he said he wanted to move again." "What do you want to do?" Mayberg asked him. "I want to clean my garage." More stringent studies, randomized, controlled, multi-institutional trials, focusing on DBS for the treatment of treatment-resistant depression are ongoing. Significantly, a pivotal study called BRODEN for Brodmann Area 25 Deep Brain Neuromodulation, initiated in 2008, was halted because early data did not show anywhere near the kind of efficacy that Mayberg had seen in her first studies. In 2013, when data were available on about 90 patients who had had DPS for at least 6 months, their depression scores were no better than the control group, patients who had undergone the surgery but without the stimulator turned on. And worse, some patients with the implant suffered multiple complications of the surgery. Some had infections. Some had intolerable headaches. Some reported increases in depression and anxiety. The trial sponsor, a company called St. Jude's, since then acquired by Abbott, halted it. As one journalist wrote, "The experience, which was searing, has sent Mayberg back to her first research principles, scrutinizing the criteria by which potential candidates for deep brain stimulation are selected, determining ways to improve implantation procedures to accommodate surgical teams less experienced with the procedure, improving methods of tweaking the device once implanted in a patient, and, most importantly, performing research to determine why DBS might not work in certain patients, and how to identify them before committing to surgery." The converse is also being studied, figuring out who is likely to be helped, and helped most rapidly, before the surgical procedure is performed. Mayberg thinks there are a variety of reasons as to why the BRODEN study went wrong. "We have to find the right patient, the right area, and the right way to monitor the response. There's a lot here that we still have to learn." Some of her harshest critics remain unconvinced. "Electroceuticals are in, and pharmaceuticals are out," a blogger wrote, with biting sarcasm that was not lost on his readers. But intriguingly, over many months, the patients in the halted study who chose to keep their DBS devices on began to experience potent and objective responses. In a paper published in Lancet Psychiatry in 2017, when patients were tracked for 2 years rather than the 6 months used in the initial analysis, 31% had experienced a remission, nearing the remission rates that Mayberg had documented in her initial studies. And so there's renewed enthusiasm for DBS for the treatment of chronic severe depression. We just have to do the study the right way, Mayberg said. The field has gone through its own cyclical mood disorder, hopelessness, followed by ecstatic and perhaps premature optimism, then a relapse into despair. Finally, there is renewed but cautious hope again. Mayberg, it seemed to me, that November afternoon had begun to feel the portent of a season turning. There were no crocuses in the gardens outside Mount Sinai West. This was November, after all. But I knew that they would bloom in February. Meanwhile, deep brain stimulation, cell circuit therapy, as I like to think about it, is being attempted for a variety of neuropsychiatric and neurological disorders, including obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD, and addiction, among others. The point is this. The electrical stimulation of cellular circuits is trying to become a new kind of medicine. Some of these attempts might succeed, some might fail. But if these attempts garner even a measure of success, they will generate a new kind of person, and personhood, humans implanted with brain pacemakers to modulate their cellular circuitry. They will presumably wander about the world with rechargeable batteries and fanny packs and move through airport security saying, "I have a battery in my body with an electrode through my skull that sends impulses into the cells of my brain to regulate my mood. Maybe I will be among them."